advantage increase their level of superiority, they will naturally tend to enjoy the subject more and more. Exactly what they enjoy can vary from subject to subject, but at least a large part of it is that they enjoy being good at it. That's a simple fact about human beings. It doesn't matter what the subject is. People like being good at things. Unfortunately, good is merely a measure of comparison. What do I mean by that? What I mean is there is no such thing as good on an absolute value. There is no absolute good. Good is always a shifting up and down based upon your competition. For example, the current world record for the 1 mile run is 3 minutes and 43 seconds. However, in 1855, the world record was 4 minutes and 28 seconds. Now, in an Occam's razor, we can assume that these two individuals were roughly the same amount of good relative to their competition in their own time in history, right? They were both the best in the world. But today, if you were to do the exact same thing that was done in 1855 and run a 428 mile, no one would care except maybe your mom who likes your photo on Instagram, and even she probably wouldn't like it on Instagram because no one cares about running a 428 mile anymore. There are high school kids that can run a 4 minute mile. It doesn't mean anything anymore. People may care if a particularly young or novice athlete reaches that time, but they will only care because they think that you have the potential to reach a time that people actually care about. The same thing could be said for virtually any subject. If you compared the best bodybuilders from 100 years ago to the best bodybuilders of today, it's not even close. Good or great is not absolute. It is merely a comparison to others at your current time. And by the way, the whole reason sports exist, the whole reason any competition of any kind exists, is because people like to feel good at something, i.e., people like to feel superior to others. So when a child develops a proficiency at something, it doesn't matter what it is, he or she will continue that thing for the mere fact that he or she is good at it. But of course, there are other benefits which can be enjoyed by becoming proficient at something. For example, the quicker you are able to read, the more you will enjoy reading. Not because you're better at it, but just because you'll enjoy the process of reading more. How does this work? Well, let's break it down a bit. What is reading? Reading is the transference of information to your brain. The quicker you read, the quicker you can obtain that new information. The limitation to reading is the eye. It's not the brain's ability to process the information. This is very similar to how the limitation to the speed at which you can consume audible information is the ear. It's not how the brain can process that information. What do I mean? Well, after a certain point, we simply cannot distinguish words from one another when audibly spoken. Think of it this way. Our brain is the hard drive to a computer. Then the information we are trying to attain is like the external hard drive. We're trying to get that information. So we hook up via a USB connection, or if it's even slower, a Bluetooth connection. Now, the computer is limited as to how fast it can attain the information via how fast the USB connection is. Of course, there are exceptions to this. I mean, you can't have a super slow computer, but I'm talking about with, you know, modern computers, the processor of the computer is going to be able to process information faster than the USB can port over that information. So the limit is the USB. Now, you can have a USB 1.0, 2.0, 3.0. At the time of this publication, there's no such thing as USB 4.0 yet, but when that comes out, hey, it's going to be even faster than 3.0, right? Now, you can take that same same computer and that same external hard drive, but the speed of transfer is limited by the connection. The average human speaks around 125 words per minute, but we actually have the capability to hear at around 400 words per minute, assuming that someone could speak that fast at an audible rate. This is like USB 1.0. The ears are not the most efficient form of transferring information to the brain. The eyes are like USB 2.0. The average human can read at a rate of about 200 words per minute, in contrast to the average rate that we hear words at, which is 125, and there are many elite readers who can read at over 1,000 words per minute, in contrast to the maximum of about 400 words per minute that we can hear. See, our brain is able to process over 400 words per minute, but the connection, the ears, are the limitation. Similarly, eyes have their own limitations as well. That's like a USB 2.0, right? It just happens to be a higher limitation than the ears. In the future, we may be able to connect a computer directly to our brain and bypass our senses and transfer information directly to the brain. This will be like the USB 3.0 or 4.0, right? We won't have the limitations of our senses. Our only limitation is going to be the actual speed that our brain can process information at. And I'm a little curious what that speed is, because I don't think anyone knows yet. Now, why did I get into all that detail? To explain how a faster reader enjoys reading more. Because the brain is so powerful and capable of processing so much information, if we don't give it enough information, the brain will get bored and start focusing on something else. This creates a snowball effect for poor readers. They aren't processing enough information to keep their minds focused, so they get distracted. Have you ever been around a person who talks really, really slowly, and you're just like, dude, talk faster? It's not that he isn't talking fast. That's not what the issue is. The issue is that you are not receiving enough information to keep you interested. Take this for example. Have you ever had a conversation where you're learning a highly technical material? Someone's trying to explain a really advanced concept, and they're hardly talking, and you keep, well, no, hold on, just stop. And you're like, you need to think about it for a second. They'll say one more sentence, and it was so freaking profound that you're like, hold on. Just let me think about it. And you just need to think about things. Your brain needs to process the information. So it's not the rate that people speak at, it's the amount of information which our brain is processing. So if you're having a conversation where there's not that much information to process, like you're just talking to some dude who's like, well, today I tried wheat bread instead of sourdough with my breakfast. You're like, dude, talk faster, because there's not any significant information that we're having to process. You get bored, and it's the same thing with reading. People think that kids who get bored with reading, that they're not smart, or they have ADD. They're not reading quick enough to satisfy their brain. Their brain gets bored, and their brain wants to focus on something else where they can get more information through that medium. If they're drawing or if they're watching TV, they're gaining more information. So it's not that they don't have the capability to read, it's that they're not reading quick enough to make their brain interested. And if your retention decreases, then you have to start rereading more and more material. Now, if you're a good reader, you're not going to understand this, but if you're a poor reader like me, right, you're reading something, and then like a couple seconds go by, like you read one sentence, and you can't remember what it was. And you have to go back, and you have to reread it. And then you read the next sentence, and then the next sentence, and then you already forgot the sentence again. You have to go back, okay, what was the sentence? And you're not retaining the information. It's coming too slowly, and then you get bored, you're not focusing on it, you're not retaining the information, and then you're rereading things, which makes the process even slower. So you become more bored and have a harder time focusing. It's that snowball effect. But it works the other way around too. If you can read more quickly, you're gonna stay more focused because your brain is more engaged. Therefore, you're gonna have higher retention rates. Everything is completely different. It's the polar opposite. And then when you're reading desirable content, the quick reader will enjoy the reading process drastically more and therefore read for longer periods of time as well as having more reading sessions. This will then continue on for years and years and is ultimately what is responsible for the humongous gap between readers and non-readers. Now, once again, I'm talking about reading, but this applies to everything in life. The reason I'm spending time on this subject is because you need to understand the importance of the accumulated advantage. Because if you are not conscious of it, you are bound to obey by its principles. However, if you understand how the accumulated advantage works, you can then start to mentally, to consciously push against it. You'll be able to push further than you normally would because you'll understand it's a small, insignificant advantage that someone else may have that in the long run will mean nothing and you need to continue pushing. You won't allow yourself to become so mentally defeated so quickly and so easily. So now let's extrapolate from reading into other areas. Originally, we were talking about how people who have better diets tend to be in better shape. And then because they are in better shape and people like being good at things, this reinforces their ability to stick to a healthy diet. Similarly, if a person was raised from a young age to eat unhealthy foods, they will start out life being overweight. They'll start out life at a disadvantage, and then they will quickly develop a negative association to proper diet because they're bad at it. They will then continue to develop negative associations to the desire for a better body because they don't feel like they will be able to attain it. So, let's relate this back to pain and pleasure. One person can resist the unhealthy food while one person cannot. One person, for some reason or another, may have started at a disadvantage when it came to diet early on and developed all of those same negative associations except to eating healthy, just like how the slow reader developed all the negative associations to reading. And the person who started out with an early advantage continued to build on those advantages, except with a separate set of benefits, like more energy and vitality, feeling better, increased focus and stamina, and everything else that comes from having a healthier diet. These secondary things will also be something the individual eventually develops a desire and positive association to. Meaning, if the person has increased energy and stamina through a healthier diet, then they are more likely to begin doing something which would benefit from having higher levels of energy and stamina, like some form of exercise. Of course, exercise will further increase the health of the person's body, which will further increase the person's desire to have a healthy body, which will in turn cause them to eat even healthier than they were before. Guys, if this sounds redundant, it's because it is. You need to understand this at a gut level, how important this cycle is, how this cycle works. So if it is going against you, it is very, very difficult to stop. You can stop your own limiting beliefs and you can become conscious of this type of stuff. You can change these associations, but you have to be aware of it. That's the first step. So let's list some of the pleasures and pains that one may have learned to associate to diet over the course of a lifetime. For the unhealthy person, healthy foods pose an unconscious threat to them, so it creates pain. People want to run away from pain, so he runs towards the opposite, which is junk food. That's his pleasure. He finds comfort in consuming junk food because it's something that he is good at. Did you hear that? It doesn't really make sense initially that he's good at consuming junk food. But is he? Yes, he is. Think about it. Why do we have eating competitions? I mean, they're not eating kale in the eating competitions, they're eating unhealthy foods. If nobody cared about being good at eating, eating competitions would not exist. People like being better than others no matter what it is. Even if it doesn't make sense, like eating food, that doesn't really seem like something to be proud of, and yet there are still eating competitions. And then let's just take a half step to drugs and alcohol. We all know people who will brag about how much of a drug they can do or how they can hold their liquor. Now, personally, I rarely drink, and I can't remember of a time I've had more than two drinks since I was, you know, about 18 or 19 years old. Sometimes I can get buzzed off of one drink, because I never drink more than two, and I don't drink that often. Over many years of going out on many, many first dates, I noticed a trend. Of course, there are exceptions to this, you know, but this, as a generalization, this is true. I found that the more a woman would drink in her life, not necessarily on the date, but just the more towards an alcoholic that she is, the more she would be turned off by the fact that I couldn't handle a lot of alcohol. That's right. If the woman drank a lot, if she was a little bit like an alcoholic, she would actually be turned off by the fact that I, like, would get a little buzzed over one drink, which when you think about it logically is a kind of a dumb thing to look down on a person for. And yet, just because they were good at consuming alcohol, they looked down on me because I was not good at doing it. And most people, even those who are alcoholics, would probably agree, yeah, alcoholism is not a good thing, and if you don't drink a lot, that's a good thing. And yet, unconsciously, they still had this lack of desire, this almost a repulse for me, a person who can't handle his liquor. These women and people in general will actually feel proud, at least unconsciously, of the fact that they can drink a lot of alcohol. And this is a truth that applies to most of us. Just think of that one scene from the Indiana Jones, the first Indiana Jones one, where we meet like the female protagonist and she's in some bar in some random country pounding back a bunch of like shots, like, you know, out drinking guys. Why does that scene seem kind of cool? You're like, oh wow, you can drink a lot of alcohol. That's not necessarily a good thing. It's kind of actually a bad thing. And yet I admit it's a cool scene. It's because she's better than a bunch of guys. She shouldn't be better than these guys who are much larger than her. And physically, just because of her size, she shouldn't be able to handle more alcohol than the guys. And yet she can. It's just because she's good at it. It's the same thing with drugs. Think back to, now I don't know if, you know, how long you're listening to this after it was published, but if you remember Charlie Sheen, when he was kind of going crazy after the 2.5 Men thing, and he was going around bragging about how much coke he could snort and how he was doing amounts of drugs on a daily basis that would kill most people, and he was proud of that. He was bragging about it. He was so proud that he, like, you know, he's like, oh, I got tiger blood. I got the tiger blood. I can do a whole bunch of coke. I got tiger blood. It will kill most people, but I got tiger blood. He's actually proud that he can do a lot of drugs. And this is not the first time that that's happened. A lot of people who smoke a lot of weed or do a bunch of drugs, they'll brag about the fact that they can do a lot of drugs. And even they know that drugs is a bad thing, but people like being good at stuff. It does not matter if it's healthy or unhealthy. It doesn't care if it's a desirable trait or an undesirable trait. It does not matter what it is. People like being better than other people at anything. So I need you to understand that, because that's going to help you be able to get rid of some of your negative habits, okay, a little bit down this 30-day program. You need to understand the pain and pleasure, and you need to understand that some of why you have some of your negative habits and some of the things that are holding you back is because you actually associate pleasure to that so-called negative habit because you're good at it, and you like being good at things even if it's a bad thing. See, this is what I was talking about on day one. It's not just about working harder. It's about working smarter. It's about actually rewiring our brain and understanding how the brain works. If we gain pleasure from eating something unhealthy, let's say something stressful happens, okay? Now, an unhealthy diet type person is going to go run for a Big Mac or something similar. A healthy diet person who's stressed out is going to run for kale or run to Whole Foods, right? They're going to run for to some sort of a healthy diet. Now, it's not because neither of them are saying, I'm stressed out and I'm going to run to something I'm good at. None of them are trying. It's the same thing with the gym, right? Some people who get stressed out, they'll smoke weed. Because that's what they're good at. That's what they're used to. Other people, they're going to go to the gym. They're stressed out. That's their default. That's just how their brain reacts. They're not consciously thinking, I'm stressed and I'm going to do something that I'm good at to de-stress myself. They just do what their habit is. But their habit is formed through their associations of pain and pleasure. And those are formed from what we're good at and what we're not good at. Now let me ask you a question. Have you ever procrastinated? I know you're saying, well, duh, Knight Rider, we've all procrastinated. But have you ever really broken down what procrastination is? Procrastination, by definition, is the avoidance of doing a task which needs to be accomplished. And isn't that really how most of us experience procrastination? It's something that we know we need to do, like write a paper or do laundry, or if you're my girlfriend, it's getting ready for anything that requires you going outside, and yet at a certain point you do write the paper. You do the laundry when you're running out of clean clothes. Or if it's my girlfriend, you do eventually get out so we can go to dinner, albeit sometimes we're a little late for the reservations. When you think about it, this doesn't really logically make sense. It's something which we know we are eventually going to do, except we have the added stress of procrastination with the task looming over our head. And then when we actually do start the task, we are even more stressed because now we have usually put ourselves in a situation where we're in a time crunch. You may not know it, but this is a prime example illustrating how the twin forces of pain and pleasure in large determine our actions. Let's break it down. We have a task. Let's use writing a paper for school as the example, because procrastinating on a paper is unfortunately something that most of us have experienced personally and can relate to, at least I know I can. We estimate consciously or unconsciously this paper should take, you know, let's say 10 hours or 15 hours, right? So 10 hours to write this paper, and we have, let's say, 2 weeks to write it. On a scale of 1 to 10, your desire to not write this paper, okay, the pain that you would get from having to write this paper would be a 7. Let's just pick, I mean, it's an arbitrary number, but let's just pick that number. It's a 7 on a scale of 1 to 10 that you do not want to do this. Now, when you get home on day 1, and you still have 14 days to write that paper, what is the pain on a scale of 1 to 10 that you would receive from not doing any writing on day 1? Well, for most people, it's hardly anything. It's a 0, 1, 2. It's a very small amount of pain for the average person that they'll receive for not doing any writing on the first day if they still have a long time to do it. Now let's say that a week goes by. You know you still have 1 week left and still haven't done any writing. Where are your pain levels right now for procrastinating? Maybe they're somewhere between a 3 and a 5. All right, so let's fast forward a little bit. Now we only have 3 days left and still no work done. Now your pain levels from procrastination are probably going to be right around that 7 out of 10 level. Now, because your level of pain from procrastination is roughly equal to your level of pain from writing the paper, now you may actually start taking steps to go ahead and write that paper. Maybe you're not going to go full on and pull an all-nighter, but you'll probably put in a few hours of work. Up until now, we have only been looking at the aspect of pain, right? Avoiding the pain. But now let's look at the other end of the equation, which is gaining pleasure. So let's go back to that point where we were 3 days plays out in our level of pain from writing the paper as well as procrastinating was about a 7 out of 10. What would happen if while at school that day, our best friend or the guy or girl that we had a big crush on came to us and said, "Hey, I won these 2 tickets on the radio to go see insert a band or DJ that you really like tonight. You want to come with me? It's free." You're like, "Hell yeah, I want to come with you and see Beyonce," or, you know, whatever it is, Skrillex, or, you know, whoever it is that you like. It's like, "Yeah, of course I'm going to do that," because the pleasure that you would anticipate from that night may be a level 9. So it overrides your desire to do the paper. The same thing would likely hold true for 2 nights before the paper was due. However, if you got that offer and it was the night before your paper was due and you still hadn't done anything or had a significant amount of work to put in, you would probably decline even though that was a super fun night and you really wanted to go on that date or hang out with your best friend, you know, seeing your DJ or your favorite band, because by that point, your pain from procrastination would be at the level 10. I mean, you know you have to get it done, and you know you have to get it done tonight. Now let's flip it up a bit. Let's say that you knew about this event 2 weeks prior. Okay, so on the day that the paper was assigned, that same person came up to you and was like, "Hey, you want to go to this super fun event with me?" And you're like, "Heck yeah, I want to go to a super fun event." Do you think that because you now were aware of this fun event the night before the paper was due, do you think you'd be a little more inspired to get that paper done early? Heck yes! Once you know and are aware that there's this event that you're going to want to go to, you start putting in the hours of writing much easier. It's not nearly as painful to do that writing. Because while the writing was maybe a pain of 7 out of 10, that event? Well, that event is a 9 out of 10 in terms of pleasure. So that pleasure is overriding the pain. You may not start writing that paper on day 1, but you might actually start doing it. You'd be at least a little bit more inspired and motivated to start on day 1. But let's say that, okay, well, you're still not going to be that motivated to start on day 1, but maybe you'll start doing it a week out instead of 2 or 3 days out. And you'll make 100% sure you are done with that paper the day before your event, not the day before it's due. This is where the play between pleasure and pain comes in. Anything we do or do not do is a combination of the pain and pleasure we receive from doing it, as well as the pain and pleasure we receive from not doing it. And then that is also weighted against the pain and pleasure of doing other things which affect the first thing. Now, people who have higher levels of anxiety tend to procrastinate less than people who have lower levels of anxiety. It's the same forces at work here, they're just affected differently. While most people can have done between 0 to 20% of the paper in the first week and leave the remaining 80 to 100% of the paper for the last week, and they'll still be relatively calm, they can just go about their day not even really thinking about the paper, people with high anxiety levels are already stressing. You assign them that paper on day, they're like, "Oh my God, I gotta start working, I gotta get this done," right? Their mind, they're not thinking differently consciously, they're not trying to think differently, they're not necessarily consciously going to try to take different actions, they don't have a different strategy, they just automatically respond differently. They're built a little bit differently over the course of their life, they've built up different associations. So for them, they start feeling that stress and they start feeling that anxiety on day 1 or week 1, whereas you would only start feeling that stress and anxiety the night before or 2 to 3 nights before. So here's the question. If we are always responding to pain and pleasure, how do we control our own decisions? How do we avoid being this stimulus response robot that just responds without thinking? The answer is focus. If we can control our focus with laser precision, then we can increase and decrease the amount of pain and pleasure that we receive from various inputs. Now, we'll be getting into that in depth later on, but for today, what I need from you is to understand that virtually everything that we do and do not do is merely a reflection of whether we are receiving more pain or more pleasure from that action. I want you to start thinking about the decisions that you are making in terms of pain and pleasure. When you do something or avoid do something, don't just beat yourself up or be happy that you did it. Ask yourself, okay, what type of pain am I receiving from this? Why am I avoiding this? Or why did I do this? What pleasure am I getting from taking this action? Think about it, analyze it, you'll find the answer, but you need to consciously think about it. Maybe you're avoiding something because you're afraid of failure, and that fear of failure is creating a pain reference for you. Or maybe you're avoiding the work because there is actually no pleasure at the other end. A lot of people, for example, will tell themselves, "I want more money." And then they'll construct this difficult, super hard, and super risky plan to make more money. But then they don't do it. When you ask them why they want more money, they may tell you, "Well, you know, I want a bigger house. I want a sports car. I want a second car and a motorcycle, and I want a yacht and a private island," right? They're just giving you these stereotypical things that they heard on some TV show, how the rich billionaires live. They don't have any real desire for the more money. Yeah, of course, we'd all kind of like to have some material possessions, but that generally, for most people, isn't enough to genuinely motivate them to take a lot of risk and work really, really hard. So if you're avoiding something that you think you want to do, ask yourself, what do you really want from this? What's the real purpose that you're doing this? Because if you can't think of a real reason, a genuine reason why you want it, it's going to be difficult for your brain to accept working 12-hour workdays, 6 or 7 days a week, for a decade straight with maybe a 5 or 10% chance of success and a 90 to 95% chance of failure and losing everything that you have. That's difficult for the brain to accept if you don't have a real reason for why you want what you're saying you want. So use your critical thinking and you will find those forces of pain and pleasure that are controlling your decisions. Once you recognize what is causing that pain and causing that pleasure, then we can begin to affect change. Now, what happens if you have a pleasure association which is roughly on the same level as a pain association? Which one wins? Will you follow the pain or will you follow the pleasure? Well, imagine this for me. You've probably heard this example before, but it's worth repeating because it's a good example. That's why you've heard it before. Now, you can adjust this level of money. If you're already quite affluent, then you can up this number of money. But for us normal people, where it's still a lot of money, imagine that you're just walking down the street and you just happen to stumble upon a $100 bill. Now, you're not in any type of a particular situation where you think it might belong to someone. You're just in some sort of, you know, you're almost like you're walking down a forest, in the middle of the forest, right? You're just kind of in a place where you couldn't even really think of who to give it to. And you just stumble upon this $100. How much pleasure do you think that's going to bring into your day? I'd be happy, right? Hey, get a little smile on my face, maybe take a selfie, like, "Woo, look what I found," right? You may post it on Facebook or Snapchat or whatever. You might call your girlfriend, like, "Hey, you know, I found $100, right? It's going to be a nice couple minutes. But beyond that, you're probably going to forget about it. By the end of the day, it's not really going to be affecting you that much. at most, it's going to give you a high for a couple minutes, maybe an hour or two if you really don't have that much money. You know, of course, if you're in a dire situation where you're like, I need exactly $100 to pay rent, it might be a little bit more. But for most people, it's not really that big of a deal. So it will bring you pleasure, but it's not going to bring you so much pleasure that it's going to be some big life-changing moment, right? It's a couple minutes of pleasure, and then you're kind of over it. Now let's look at the opposite. Let's say that you're about to pay for something at a store. You pull out your $100 bill and then you drop it accidentally. And just as you do, some homeless person runs by, snatches the $100 and runs away. Now be honest. Now maybe if you're a lady, maybe you won't run after this guy in your 6-inch heels, but if you're a dude, be honest. Are you just gonna sit there and go, eh? Okay, or are you gonna like I'm gonna get my $100. Like, I don't care if I'm gonna go to jail. Like, I'm gonna get my $100 back, right? And that's most guys in my experience. If that happens to them, they're gonna do what they're gonna do to get their $100 back, even if it's like the negative result far outweighs that $100. They just go into crazy person mode. They're gonna get their $100 back. Now, but let's just say that the homeless person disappears, right? You can't find them. You can't get the money back, okay? How upset are you gonna be? And maybe this is where you can come back in if you're a lady and you weren't gonna go crazy. Maybe you'd like sick your boyfriend or husband on the, go get him. Go get my $100. But the homeless person disappears, okay? Is that the thing you're supposed to call them? Homeless, not bums, homeless people, right? The housing challenged. So tell me, how pissed off are you gonna be? How much time are you gonna spend talking to security, maybe trying to contact the police, asking the security and wherever you are about surveillance cameras, telling every single one of your friends, oh, poor me, I lost $100, it was stolen from me by a housing impaired individual. You're gonna go on all your social media platforms, not just one or two, you're gonna go on all of them and be like, oh my god, listen what happened to me, feel sorry for me. How many 15-minute phone conversation, like how many, really, honestly, really, how many people are you going to call and have 15-minute phone conversations telling the exact same story over and over? Hey, mom, let me tell you what happened. Hey, dad, let me tell you what happened. Hey, girlfriend, let me tell you. Hey, brother, hey, friend. Over and over. Now, maybe this isn't you. Maybe you wouldn't care one way or another. Now, there is a type of individual who wouldn't really care that much, but this is a person who tends to be indifferent to both situations. If they found the $100, they wouldn't really care. They'd be apathetic towards it. And if they had the $100 stolen from them or they lost it, they also would be similarly apathetic. So it's not that they necessarily care more or less. They just tend to not really care at all. See, the difference is the exact same, $100. And yet our response tends to be way more amplified when we're dealing with the pain, when we're dealing with the loss. This illustrates how we respond to pain versus how we respond to pleasure. I would love to tell you that the world is all rainbows and unicorns and lollipops and we can exclusively focus on the positive to affect change. But this example should demonstrate to you the increased power of pain over pleasure. Now, how significant that difference is will vary from person to person. Some people will be way more motivated by pain, and some people will only be a little bit more motivated by pain. But the large majority of people are more motivated by avoiding pain and avoiding loss than they are in gaining pleasure and gaining things that they don't already have. I.e., people will work harder to avoid a reduction in their standard of living more so than they will work to increase their standard of living, if that makes sense. Now, once again, I do want to note that if you're an affluent individual, you may want to raise that from $100 to a much larger amount, like $100,000 or $1 million, because the truth of the matter is $100 to you would be nothing. Just like to a normal person, it would be the equivalent of dropping a penny, right? For us normal people, if we dropped a penny and some homeless person came and stole the penny and ran away, we wouldn't be upset. We'd be like, LOL, that person actually like cares about a penny, right? We wouldn't care about the penny. But when it becomes a significant amount of money to us for whatever our standard of living is, that's when we start to go into that negative state. So once again, if you're rich, hey, just, all right, make it $1 million or 10 million or you know, whatever is a lot of money to you. And then you'll be able to accurately determine how much more important and significant pain is to you in terms of motivation than pleasure is. So for most people, pain is several times more powerful of a motivator. The problem is that pain tends to only exist when things get particularly bad. They only exist at the very low end of the living scale. That's why the large majority of people are not homeless, but the large majority of people also don't extend to anything beyond the middle class. They are perfectly comfortable to just be comfortable. They want to have enough money so they can not be homeless, so they can have a car for basic transportation, so they have enough money to eat somewhat, you know, desirable food, and so they can take care of their family. That's about as far as most people's motivation goes, because that's where natural motivation stops for most people. There are those people who are just genetically designed to be 100% complete, I mean, just insatiable in terms of their satisfaction. And I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing overall in life, because it's very difficult to focus that type of thing into just one area. If they're those types of people who tend to not be satisfied in business also tend to not be satisfied with their body, to not be satisfied in their relationships, and it can cause a lot of other issues, and they're not necessarily the most healthy people. Your goal is to be able to consciously focus that so you can say, hey, listen, I want to have satisfaction. I want to have happiness in my relationships and with my family. And if you're spiritual, then in your spiritual life, but you want to remain unsatisfied in your financial situation. But you can only do that if you're consciously able to control it. The goal is you need to be able to control your focus and manually stimulate that pain and pleasure response. Now, the distinction between the lower end of the financial class and the middle class, that's more about what their upbringing was and certain environmental influences that they had. So if someone was raised in the middle class, they're going to work a lot harder to stay in that middle class compared to a person who was raised in the lower class. That person is not going to work nearly as hard. Now, I'm talking as a generalization. Of course, there are always exceptions. That's how we get the rags to riches. But as a whole, when you look at them from a statistical demographic group, people who were born in a lower income family, that's generally where they're going to stay because that's what their standard of living is. That's what they're used to. That's what they feel comfortable in. Now, of course, some of them are still going to make it to the middle class, but a higher percentage of people who started in the middle class are going to stay there. And that's because their standard of living is already there. So for them, going to the lower class, even though they'll still have all the basic necessities, they'll still have a roof over their head for the most part, they'll still have a mostly functioning car for the most part, they'll still be able to put food on the table, maybe not quite as healthy of and nutritious of food, but they'll still be able to consume enough calories to survive. So they'll be able to still have the basic necessities, but that's still a step down for them because they started in the middle class. And we are willing to work 10 times as hard to not lose something than we are to gain something. However, this difference mostly only exists within that lower class to middle class. Now, I'm not including the upper class right now. I'm saying when you just look at those two classes, their main differences are only between going from the lower class to the middle class. If you extrapolate out, you see the lower class individual and the middle class individual are going to be equally motivated to avoid homelessness. Similarly, they're going to have about equal motivation to get up to a higher class, because regardless of where you start, moving up requires the same amount of motivation. Similarly, moving down, whether you're in the lower class or the middle class, going homeless is still a step down. So that difference between the lower class and the middle class, it's only between those, jumping between those two classes. But going up and going down is still the same. So remember, both the middle class and the lower class will work much harder to avoid becoming homeless than they will to attain the upper class status. Logically, one may at least initially think that this is not a fair comparison, as most people will say, well, it requires a lot more work to reach the upper class than it does to avoid being homeless. And on an absolute scale, kind of an in reality type scale, of course this is true. You, of course, have to do more work to achieve more. But this is not the way that our brain works. For example, we all have those friends who don't really do much with their life. You know the types of people that I'm talking about. It's where it's kind of like their only purpose is to tell you how the new like Netflix shows are doing. Like, oh yeah, what type of Netflix show? Like, you know, like if you're curious about some type of a new show, like you ask that person because they've seen everything. All they do, they wake up, they maybe brush their teeth, and then they watch Netflix for like 12 hours. It's that type of a person. Have you ever come home from a 10-hour day of work and you like worked your butt off at the office or at your business, and then even after that or before work you still hit the gym like a boss, and then you talk to your friend who just rewatched the 9th season of Grey's Anatomy for the 3rd time, and you talk to them and they're like, oh my gosh, I am like literally so exhausted, and you're like, you didn't do anything. I mean, you don't say that, but in your head, you're like, you didn't do it. Well, I mean, okay, sometimes I say that. Like, you didn't do anything. You watched TV all day long. But the somewhat, the kind of awkward truth, if that's the right word, the awkward truth is that sometimes it can actually be more exhausting to watch TV all day than it is to go out and actually do something with your life. Think about it. Haven't you had those times where you thought it would be so cool that you had this time off, but then you actually did have the time off, and you had a little bit too much time off, and you were the one sitting in front of the TV all day long, you lost all your momentum, your diet got bad, you exercised less, you stopped doing basic things like, you know, putting on clothes that aren't pajamas and shaving on a regular basis? You lose all sense of drive and purpose in your life. So you enter depression, which only strengthens and repeats that cycle. You just spiral in that hole, and it gets worse and worse and worse. Think back to that feeling, that level of destructiveness. Even though you were literally doing nothing, did it feel easy? Were you just completely free of all stress? Was your life really that much better and more amazing when you were doing nothing with it? If you are the type of person who's listening to this program, I would hallucinate not. I would also hallucinate that once you actually broke that pattern and started getting things accomplished, didn't you actually start to feel better? When you got out of the house and stopped looking at a razor like it was a piece of abstract art? What is this concoction? What am I supposed to do with this? and you got your diet, these are the jokes, people, and you also, you got your diet back on track, you got your exercise back on track, and you got that sense of purpose back to your life, didn't you feel so much more energized and satisfied with life? See, just because you were doing more stuff after you got out of your depression and you were working harder, that didn't necessarily mean that you were less happy or that you were more stressed out. A lot of times it's the opposite. You start working more and you become more happy, more satisfied, and less stressed. Or at least, I mean, of course, you're always still going to have some stress, but it's less stress than the stress that you have from feeling like there's no purpose to your life. Think about it. Think of one of the more intense times that you were working when you were completely exhausted, okay? Think back to that time where you had a full day of work. I mean, a big day, a lot of hours, and they were not easy hours. These were stressful hours. This is the type of work that you can't continue permanently, right? It's that type of a day where it's like, okay, I got a couple of these and then I'm burnt out. But you accomplished in an extraordinarily large amount. You accomplished in that day what normally it would have taken you several days to accomplish. You came home exhausted and collapsed on your bed. You were stressed, but tell me that you didn't take a deep breath, close your eyes, and feel a deep, powerful moment of satisfaction and accomplishment. Tell me that you were not proud of yourself, 100% satisfied for that day at that moment, because you know that you did what you had to do that day. You got it done. And yet, here's your friend who watched 16 hours of TV in her pajamas complaining about life. So no, working more does not necessarily mean more stress or a less happy life. So why is it then that so many of us will do what is necessary to maintain our present standard of living, whether that be making $20,000 a year or $200,000 a year, but will not push to increase beyond that? Can you guess it by now? What's today all about? Pain and pleasure. It is because regardless of where your current standard of living is, we all behave similarly. We will all work 10 times harder to not lose, i.e. maintain that current standard of living, than we will to gain the pleasure of increasing our standard of living. Just like how we were more upset that we had that money stolen from us, that $100 or whatever it is for you, than the happiness that we gained from finding $100, even though it was the same amount. As stated before, the way we can change this is by changing our focus. We have to manufacture a larger loss. What do I mean by this? I'll tell you guys a little secret. Now, this is a little weird and it's maybe a little embarrassing, but I am continually looking for things that will nearly end modern civilization as we know it. I am always searching the news for some found asteroid which has a 2% chance of hitting the Earth and nearly destroying it in a decade or two decades. And if it does, you know, modern society is just completely gone. Half the Earth is gonna die and only the rich will continue to live with modern conveniences. I'm looking decades into the future when climate change and shortages of water and food and oil will create worldwide hysteria and hundreds of millions of people will die and only the rich are safe. I hope for the day when they create some form of life extension where a person's consciousness and potentially body can live on indefinitely. But due to overpopulation, it's been banned in most countries and you can only get it if you fly to China and buy it on the black market for tens of millions of dollars. I pray that Elon Musk will succeed in his venture to establish a permanent self-sustaining society on Mars, and then one day, a plague breaks out on Earth, and that will kill everyone on Earth, and the only way to safety is to get, one of the remaining 500 seats available on the final shuttles launching to Mars before we all become infected. I should note that I only mean I pray Elon Musk succeeds in going to Mars, not the whole the entire world dies of a plague thing. Now, I admit thinking about these partial doomsday situations is a little silly, but look at them in detail. They all have some commonalities. In all of them, a large chunk of the world will die, but the rich will continue living on as they were before. And they are also all a few decades in the future, right? None of them are like tomorrow. They're all a bit out in the future, so they still affect me, but I still have time to work to try to earn that money to avoid it. See, as often as I think about this stuff, I have never once in my entire life thought about a situation where the entire Earth was destroyed. Because it's pointless for me to think about that. I've also never once thought of anything where it happens in a very short time frame, and I also don't think of things that happen hundreds of years in the future long after I'm dead, unless it's that life extension thing. It's always a very specific type of a doomsday that I'm looking at. It's somewhere 10, 20 years in the future, and it's always where most of the population will suffer and only the rich will succeed. And that gives me the, and I know it's totally weird, it's totally silly to talk about it, but that gives me motivation to make more money. See, the number one thing that I fear is death. I am so scared of dying. I understand that not everyone is like me. Some people are totally cool with death and they don't mind dying young. But as far as I'm concerned right now, I don't ever want to die. Death is my number one fear above all else. So I use that to my advantage. I construct these somewhat Looney Tunes situations, but all of them are completely possible, so they make sense to my logical mind, and then I experience the fear of death, and I experience it today, even though it may never happen, or it may be decades in the future, it may be long after I'm dead. I construct that in my mind, I make it vivid, I imagine it, and then I sense that fear now, and it creates that pain behind me. See, I am no longer pulling towards something. I'm not pushing against a wall. I have the fear of death behind me, and I'm running away from it. And we will always work harder to avoid pain than gain pleasure. I change the input, right? I change what I'm focusing on, but the output is the same. I work harder. The result is the same. I earn more money. I am simply tapping into that much more powerful motivational source of pain and fear. Now, this example may not work for you, but the point is you want to figure out what your largest sources of pain are in this life. What causes your depression? What do you fear? What do you want to avoid at all costs? And then use some critical thinking and some imagination to construct a source of motivation that will push you so you can work harder. So it's time for today's change. Today we are going to go over one area of your life which needs improvement. Now, I'm going to be doing this with you live, so I'll ask you a question, and then I'll give you some time to think about it. And if you need a little bit more time, just go ahead and pause the program. I'll be waiting for you here when you get back, alright? So, the first thing I want you to do is to select an area of your life which you would like to see change in. A few examples would be your health. Maybe you'd like to start exercising more and improve your diet, or maybe you'd like to stop smoking or drinking. Maybe it's a behavioral issue like an anger problem. It could be financial. You want more income, or you want to improve your business. Maybe your love life isn't as good as you'd like it to be. You're single and ready. ready to mingle, or you want more fulfillment from your current relationship. Maybe it's something else, but I'm going to give you about 10 seconds here, and I want you to pick an area of your life that you would like to work on. So go ahead and do that now. Okay, if you need more time, go ahead and pause the program now. Otherwise, we're going to continue on. Now, what I want you to do is think of a couple actions associated with your choice. If you want a better body, these would be things like avoiding overeating, healthier types of foods, going to the gym, playing sports or physical activities. If you want a more fulfilling relationship, it might be taking your partner out for dinner more often, or doing small nice acts of kindness and love, like, you know, doing the dishes or taking out the trash, doing their laundry, or doing something that they enjoy which maybe you don't enjoy, like watching their favorite show which maybe you don't like. If you have already selected a specific action that you want to change, like quitting smoking, then I want you to think back to when you began that habit and think of what positive associations you began to build around it. Okay, so I'm going to give you a full minute to think about this, and I want you to use every second. Don't stop short on me. Use the full minute to think of as many actions as you can that would help you accomplish change in the area of your choice. Okay, go ahead and do that now. Any action that you can think of, anything that you can think of, just go ahead and write it down or think about it.